something American.
Okay. So today we're going to move on and talk about EEG. So we've kind of moved up from the body up into the head. Before we get into that, though, we'll start with just the usual announcements and 3x5 cards. The recurring announcement, just so nobody can say they're surprised when the date comes, you'll want to have your one or two paragraph prospectus to me by that date. And I'll send you some feedback by email. That feedback may be, do it, sounds great. That feedback may be, this sounds really complicated, let's chat. Or it could be something in between, that this is a good idea and here's some other suggestions for you. Okay. Either after one iteration or two iterations of this paragraph procedure, you'll get an email from me approving you to do the topic, and then you know, just move ahead and do it. All right, so from last time, a few of the many good inquiries that we had. So one of them was a question that was asked last time in class, and that is there a similar modulation in depression of startle amplitude in response to different emotional stimuli? And I couldn't recall off the top of my head whether there was, and then I remembered, and I should have remembered, actually, there was a study by a character named Alan, Nick Allen, who's in Australia. And he did this study looking at clinically depressed patients and non-depressed patients. And in this graph, pleasant are dark and neutral are kind of white and unpleasant are gray. And so in the non-depressed people, you see the kind of prototypic startle probe modulation. Remember, the amplitude of the startle blink response is in fact largest when there's a negative affect. That the person's looking at an unpleasant picture. These are standardized T-score, so they're conducted within subjects, so everybody's individual mean across all three valences is 50. So there's no, that way if there's small placements in electrode that vary across people, there's not any problem with the overall unit. Okay. The depressed patients, on the other hand, statistically don't show any modulation at all. These are not significantly different from one another. There were only 14 depressed patients and 14 controls in the study. But most importantly, they certainly don't show, if anything, this is in the wrong direction. Okay? So statistically, there's nothing going on, and descriptively, if there is anything going on, it appears to be in the wrong direction. So we can say based on this, there's no good evidence that depressed patients are showing startle inhibition to pleasant stimuli, and no statistical evidence that they're showing startle potentiation to aversive stimuli. Now, one of the things that Nick did in this paper was also to look at the severity of depression, and that turned out to be important. So now this takes, again, the whole sample. Most of the controls, all the controls are down here, plus one depressed person, have a Beck depression inventory score of 0 to 18. So all the other depressed, 13 depressed people, have a Beck 19 or greater. And what you can see is that the controls and the mildly depressed people here show a relatively reasonable startle potentiation and startle inhibition pattern. So they potentiate to aversive stimuli and they have an inhibition to appetitive stimuli. And it's really these more severely depressed people who show the aberrant pattern, where not only do they not show the inhibition to pleasant stimuli, but they show a potentiation. So it might suggest they clearly process appetitive stimuli differently, and in some sense they may even provide some kind of an aversive experience for them to see these stimuli. Now, there was also a study that just came out looking at this last year in motion, and this was a study now of 150-some people after they got rid of all the people who didn't startle and had artifacts. This is a study by Chris Larson and Jack Nitzke and Ritzy Davidson. And they had, now these are not clinically depressed people, these are college students who've been defined in terms of extreme scores in terms of depression or anxious arousal, which is kind of a somatic anxiety, or anxious apprehension, which is kind of a worry group. And looking at this, again, and now they have not done any kind of standardization of scores. So these are just raw microvolt units. And it probably would be a little cleaner if you did standardize it within people, but all that's going to do with the raw microvolt units is add some noise. So the fact that they still find effects is just a testament to the strength of them. And now we have unpleasant in black. So the color coding here is exactly opposite what it was from Nick Allen, who's in Australia. So I think, you know, when you're down under.
Black blood too, right?
What?
Black
yes. Blood. Yes. So the Nick Allen has pleasant or dark, and on this side, and these have pleasant or light, and on this side. But, you know, you're in Australia, everything's that way. So This is how it is. So here are the controls, and they show the startle potentiation to the aversive stimuli. They don't show startle inhibition to appetitive stimuli. Their explanation for that is they didn't use a lot of erotic stimuli, and that's where most of that kind of inhibition occurs, to those kinds of stimuli. And the worriers don't look that different, but it's the anhedonic depressives and the anxious arousal folks that really look different, again showing an enhanced startle to positive images. Another question was, how do anticholinergic drugs affect DMG activity? Would you see a difference between a control subject and someone taking such a drug when measuring startle response or some other facial EMG site? So remember, at the neuromuscular junction, the nerve comes down and releases acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, and that's what causes the muscle action potentials to occur. And we talked about Botox as blocking entirely the presynaptic release of acetylcholine. Of course, the botulinum toxin does it too. Botox is just a controlled way to do it, or somewhat controlled way to do it. So if you block it, of course, the muscle won't work. But the acetylcholinergic drugs are postsynaptic receptor blockers. And unless you had some extremely, extremely high dose, they only block some of the receptor sites and only for some of the time. So the muscles still, in fact, do work. But that signal uses acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, and Botox inhibit the release presynaptically. Anticholinergics block postsynaptic muscarinic receptors. There's two types of acetylcholine receptors, nicotinic and muscarinic, and the muscarinic are the ones that are blocked here. And it turns out they are used in the treatment of certain neuromuscular conditions, like spasms of the gastrointestinal tract and overactive bladder syndrome. So anticholinergics then kind of reduce the propensity of those muscles to contract when you don't want them to contract. Okay? Now those are both smooth muscle. I couldn't find as much data on what they do to striate muscle per se, but there's some evidence that they provide muscle relaxant properties. So some physicians are apparently prescribing them amongst the whole arsenal of muscle relaxants. So that would suggest they are working on striate muscle as well. So I guess the take-home message to be safe is you'd want to exclude people on anticholinergics if possible. Of course, sometimes your study design is such that, you know, the group of interest may be more likely to be on those kinds of medications. But one thing that could still work in your favor, even if one group is taking these, would be that often we're not looking at raw values, but we're looking at patterns within people. And so if we're looking at, for example, emotion-modulated effects on corrugator, zygomatic, or orbicularis, this should affect, you know, all classes of response. And so there might be an overall either slower or less intense response, but still you should see the pattern preserved. So that would be the pattern for those depressed people. This would be the pattern for the normal folks. All right. Now, just to make sure, did you say that we can only have within subjects designed because of the difficulty to place EMG electrodes? If so, how can you compare groups? Well, I did say that if you want to compare amplitude, you can't do raw amplitudes across people and have it be meaningful. If you have very, very large samples and we assume that, you know, placement errors are random, then placement errors are just noise, but you're going to need much larger samples to compare between people. On the other hand, you can clearly have between subjects designs as long as there's a within subject variable as well. So the startle probe manipulation, the modulation according to valence, is a good example of that. So then we can look at a pattern of response between groups. So you're looking for a group by valence, or a group by arousal, or a group by your variable here, interaction. And that's done quite often. Okay. A question on the data processing stream for EMG: should you smooth the data before looking at the amount of EMG activity? And can you explain that last stage of the schematic of signal transformation again? So maybe I can answer the smoothing question and the other question all by going to that diagram again. So you recall that we started out with a signal that was an AC signal, alternating current, oscillating around a baseline of zero, because there's a filter built into these amplifiers so that it doesn't drift. It just stays right around zero. Then we do some form of rectification, either where we get rid of the negative numbers or we take the absolute value, so that in essence everything is now a positive number. And then the dispersion in this direction is going to give us an indication of the intensity of the EMG activity. Then this step here shows the smoothing. Okay? And the question is, why would you want to smooth? Well, let's imagine that you had just a kind of a very brief and transient spike right here, and it was actually higher than this peak. Okay? That doesn't show here, but that would be something that could happen. So if you were just picking the peak, you might pick the peak to be earlier and even higher than this place here, even though a majority of the activity in that example would still be right here. If you were to smooth it, you might get a small peak and then the main peak here. So smoothing can help you see the bigger trend, and it will tend to attenuate just very, very brief spikes. Smoothing will also, given the noisiness of the signal, tend to give you a better estimate of the central tendency here. Otherwise, you're going to have, you know, with this, it's kind of the same problem as with the EKG that I diagrammed. When there's some noise in the signal, your absolute peak and timing of that peak are going to change a little bit, but if you smooth it, then you'll have a more reliable measure of it. So that's why you'd want to smooth it. And then the question, what the heck's the last thing? I think that's paraphrasing the question. This is an integrator, so it's summing over time. So if you just took this plus this plus this plus this, over time it would kind of continually increase. And it would increase rapidly, then not so much, rapidly, and then not so much. And then it flattens out here at the end, as a matter of fact. And integrators don't simply sum. They also, for lack of a better term, they leak. So they have a little bit of the summed activity reduced per unit of time. And so the analogy I made with a leaky bucket, and you pour water into it, and if the water's going in faster than it leaks out, then the level rises. And when you have an integrator like that, then you can see, ultimately, if you have the time constant right on it, it will look like smoothing as well. The reason that that's even important is that in the old systems before digital signal processing, this was all done in a series of little boxes that had little plugs and maybe a couple of knobs. And you'd do all this processing and you'd finally get out one thing at the end, and it would go through these things. So the contour following integrator as the last step produced something that looks more like this if you had your time constant set right. If you had your time constant set wrong, it produced something that looked like that. But in terms of what you would do for the digital signal processing if you're doing an EMG study, you get the data, you do some filtering and rectifying, and then you do some smoothing and pick a peak, usually if you're interested in something like startle probe, or you might just be interested in the whole area during the time the subject's viewing something, like there's a snake on the screen and you're interested in the EMG activity during the period of viewing of the snake, and then you could just take the entire area of that signal. I guess that's it for 3x5 this time. So any other questions before we start on the EEG? Okay, so now we'll be talking about electroencephalography, EEG, brainwaves amongst the colloquial vernacular. And the EEG is just an oscillating voltage that we record from the scalp surface, and it reflects a very large number of neurons simultaneously active. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There you go. Okay, one more coming back. Any more? All right. Now, you can record EEG by going underneath the skull and into the brain, but we usually don't do that in our human subjects for obvious reasons. Although there are sometimes populations where that's done. People with intractable seizures, for example, may have strip electrodes placed in the brain to try to help localize the seizure prior to being considered for surgery. And in those cases, you know, the electrode's already there and you can record intracranial. Well, it would be deep brain recording, it wouldn't be deep brain stimulation, but deep brain stimulation would be another case. The very same electrodes that provide deep brain stimulation, which are usually done therapeutically, for example, to alleviate tremors or alleviate pain, those electrodes can also be used to record if you turn the stimulation off. So, okay. But, you know, anytime you go down into the brain and you put things there, you risk infection, you risk damaging tissue, and you know, you don't really need those kinds of things unless you have some reason to do them. So recording from the surface is a reasonable alternative, but as you move further and further out from the source, you're recording larger and larger pools of neurons, and you're missing very localized activity in many cases. And this is fairly small voltage. It's on the order of 50 microvolts or 50 millionths of a volt. So it's a pretty tiny signal. Just for comparison, the AA battery that you might be familiar with in a camera or something has 30,000 times as much voltage as what you have on the surface of your scalp. And a wall socket has 2.2 million times as much. So obviously this isn't a very good source of power for anything. Now, when we talk about EEG in the frequency domain, we're interested in how fast these oscillations occur. And there are some arbitrary, semi-arbitrary divisions going from fastest on the top to slowest on the bottom. Many of these distinctions are carried forward historically. People talked about them at having these cut points. And there's, of course, some debate about, is the delta theta border 3.5? Is it 4? Is it 4.5? But it's somewhere around there. And one of the reasons we still keep this kind of distinction is that there are different behavioral and subjective correlates to activity in these different frequency bands. Okay. So let me just show you an example of what this looks like. So I just took these came out of the same subject file. This is awake subject. So we don't see the huge kind of delta waves that you might see during sleep, but there is delta present even here. What you're looking at here is 3 seconds of data. This solid line is 1, this solid line is 2, and the line not on the screen would be 3 seconds. So each of these little dashed lines represents a 200 millisecond increment. So as you look, the delta being in the 1 to 4 hertz region, you might see, if we just count, there's 1, 2, 3 peaks, 1, 2 peaks, 1, 2 peaks, so it's in the 1 to 4 hertz region. Okay. When people are awake, and not particularly drowsy and not under the influence of substances, you shouldn't see a predominance of delta waves. Okay. Now, theta activity is in the range of 4 to 7 hertz. And again, if we count, let's start here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's right in the 4 to 7 hertz region. Okay. Now, if you see diffuse theta widely distributed throughout the cortex, that might be an indication of some degree of drowsiness or some degree of pathology. On the other hand, theta, if focally in regions like the midline frontal region, can indicate things like focused attention and be related to memory and recruitment of other brain systems. So theta is this kind of interesting component, depending where you record it and under what experimental circumstances, could represent something relatively bad, low arousal, sleepiness, pathology, or something really good. It's midline frontal theta or hippocampal theta being recruited for attention and memory purposes. Alpha is in the 8 to 13 hertz range. So again, if we just prove it to ourselves, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, almost 10. So that's again right in the 8 to 13 hertz range. Alpha is going to be seen especially prominently over the occipital region when people close their eyes. So when there's a cessation of active visual input to the occipital cortex, the primary visual cortex, then you see a predominance of alpha. And when people open their eyes, you'll see alpha blocking, and it just means the alpha seems to go away. Okay? And this was one of the most visible features in the EEG prior to having computers and digital signal processing, and so a lot of the early work that we do is based on alpha, because it was easy to see, it was easy to quantify. Beta is above alpha but below gamma. Okay? And beta may behave differently depending on where it is in the range. Some of beta seems to look a bit like alpha. Some of beta seems to look a bit like gamma. So I'm just going to hold off on making any broad generalization about behavioral correlates of beta at this point. You can see here it's a broad range, and there might be a couple of different kinds of frequencies going on in this signal, because you see there's it's not just, these are kind of unimodal bumps, and here you start to have more bumps suggesting potentially a couple different frequencies in there. Gamma frequency, 30 to 50 hertz. Notice that the amplitude is getting smaller. Okay? And that tends to be the case, that the slowest signals involve the greatest populations of neurons, and they're going to have the largest amplitude. And these faster frequencies have involve more local populations of neurons, and they're going to have smaller amplitude. And gamma activity is seen in active cortical processing, so it's going to be seen when the region of cortex from which it's coming is actively involved in processing something. If you saw a lot of gamma and you could rule out that it might be coming from EMG sources, then you could suggest that the person is actively engaged in a task, they're processing a stimuli, they're doing some kind of work, hopefully related to your task, or at least some kind of work in some sort. And then finally, out of the EEG signal, I also filtered it to get EMG activity. So this is not EMG recorded as we would typically record it, a couple of bipolar electrodes, but actually recorded at an EEG site. So remember I showed you the picture of the EMG, or the muscles all over the head last time. They were everywhere. Well, they continue, and there's muscles all over your head. And so you can pick up EMG also in the EEG. And when you have a single electrode and you just see a complex signal, you don't necessarily know which source it comes from. But you can see clearly that it's there as well. And the way that I did this was just by putting different filters on the signal. So they were all these different frequencies were present in the signal. Okay. Now, EEG, I happen to think, is a pretty useful procedure that you can use in your research. And one of the reasons certainly is it's relatively non-invasive. I say relatively because some people don't like the goop that they get in their hair or the fact that they have this cap on their head. But, all things considered, we're not injecting any radioactivity. People with metal in their face can still participate in this. We're not going underneath the skin. We're not going inside the brain. It's relatively non-invasive. And it has excellent time resolution. We can pick up changes on the order of milliseconds. In fact, as we'll see in a lecture or two, very small changes in the timing of particular, bumps in the waveform can be indicative of demyelinating diseases like MS. So even a few millisecond changes in some of these appearance of some of these features can be diagnostically useful. So it has excellent time resolution. And that compares to things like, positron emission tomography. Even if you're doing activation studies, you're looking at 30 seconds to a minute at least. If you're looking at MRI, it depends on how you set up the experiment, but it's probably time resolution like skin conductance on the order of a second to 3 second moving window. So EEG clearly has the best time resolution of any of these kinds of imaging technologies. So where does it come from? Well, it comes from the brain, but in the brain there are a variety of different kinds of cells. And there are, of course, glial cells that provide structural support. We wouldn't expect them to produce a lot of EEG activity. And to the extent that they do, it's probably just slow shifts over a very long period of time. So you can think about it almost as direct current. It's not oscillatory, but it's just a slow, steady shift that you can sometimes see. But that wouldn't really be of interest for most of what we do. So what's left then? Well, there's fluid, that's not going to do it, it's neurons, right? And the neurons are going to be the source of it. But it's not going to be the action potentials. The action potentials are very, very high frequency, and the brain tissue has strong capacitance effects, so it ends up acting as a low-pass filter, and it filters out those very high-frequency spikes. So if you were able to go into the brain and down right next to a neuron with your electrode, you could record action potentials. But as you start to move a bit of a distance away from the neuron that's generating the action potentials, then you won't see them anymore. You'll just be left with these slower potentials. So what's left are these slower waves, and they're primarily the result of the summation of large numbers of excitatory and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. And the way we talk about this is they come from what we call functional synaptic units. That's just a way of saying a lot of neurons that are simultaneously active. So you're looking at hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of neurons simultaneously active to be able to generate the kind of signal that we would record at the surface of the cortex or the surface of the scalp. So if we look at this, this diagram just shows what I was trying to talk about here. A couple things to notice. We're moving from the top to the bottom, from inside a cell to outside the cell, to the surface of the cortex to the surface of the scalp. And as we do so, the amplitude changes dramatically. Here we're starting at 50 millivolts, and up here we're at 50 microvolts. Okay, so it's a thousand-fold difference in the size of the potential from inside the cell to up at the surface. Now, if you're recording right in the cell body, you can see EPSPs and IPSPs, and of course, if the EPSP is sufficiently large, you'll get depolarizations, and those are the action potentials. So that would be what you'd see if you were recording intracellularly. And if you moved your recording probe just outside the cell, so now it's extracellular, you'd see a flip in polarity, right? Because if the inside is negative, then the outside is positive, and vice versa. So the signal flips in polarity, and there still is some presence of action potentials if you're very close to the cell. But as you move up to the cortex, now you'll see those action potentials are gone, and all you're left with is really the approximation of the IPSPs and EPSPs summing there to produce this oscillatory waveform. And then finally, the skull is rather resistive to signals. It's not impervious, but the signals do pass through it with quite a degradation in their amplitude. You can see they go from about 200 microvolts at the surface of the cortex to about 50 at the surface of the scalp. And so now you just see a reduction in the amplitude there. But if this precise drawing here is drawn to precision, you'll notice the timing of these events lines up very clearly. So we don't, there's virtually instantaneous conduction of the signal from the source to the surface through volume conduction. In the same way that if, electrical charge hits the pool, there's virtually instantaneous conduction of the electrical signal through the pool. Well, where there's electrical signals within the brain, they're instantaneously conducted. So the timing remains the same. What's changed is the amplitude and also the morphology as these action potentials are filtered out. Okay, and so the synaptic potentials are going to be a majority of the EEG. Now, sometimes there are some after potentials where there's a little bit of kind of volley or oscillation as it returns towards its resting potential. That could contribute a little bit, but we think that most of this is functional synaptic units, large populations of neurons simultaneously active. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about alpha up front because it's going to form the basis of some of the initial applications that we'll talk about in these series of lectures on EEG. And just by way for a roadmap here, today we're going to cover kind of basics of EEG recording, and we'll start on some applications looking at alpha asymmetries and emotion and depression. We'll move on to talk about other frequency domain applications, and then we'll turn towards talking about event-related brain potentials, and these are things not so much in terms of the frequency domain, but usually thought of more in the time domain. And then finally, the last couple of lectures will be some advanced topics in EEG. So we're pretty much going to live EEG from here to the end in various forms. So, now EEG has been recorded since the 1920s when Berger discovered the EEG. And alpha was noticed quite early, and as I alluded to earlier, one of the reasons for this is it's obvious and really quite hard to miss. And so here we have 32 channels, well, it's about 30 channels of EEG, a couple channels of eye movements up at the top, that's what the VEOG channels are, a couple of EMG down at the bottom, but the subject is just sitting here with his or her eyes closed, and what you can see right here and right here, and the black arrows that don't show up are pointing to it, is these bursts, these oscillations here, and those are alpha bursts. And if you look at the whole record, now that I pointed them out, they're probably one of the most noticeable features of the record. Now, we're looking at here 1 second from solid line to solid line. So again, if we want to count, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So again, 8 to 13 hertz, it's alpha in there. You'll also notice that the sites from where it's coming are O2 and OZ, those are occipital sites, and O1, an occipital site. So it's over the occipital cortex during a period where the subject has his or her eyes closed. And you compare that to a record like this one, where the subject has his or her eyes open, and you don't see a large preponderance of alpha. So it's big, hard to miss. It can account for a large proportion of the variance in EEG activity in the adult human brain. So what do we know about alpha and what do we know about its functional significance? Well, historically, it was thought to be just a consequence of timing from signals to go from the thalamus to the cortex and back. So based upon the conduction velocity and the distance and the time for the synapse, that if you have the thalamus talking to the cortex, sending signals back to the thalamus, that this would take about 8 to 10 cycles per second, and there you had alpha. That's what it was supposed to be. But a study by Adrian demolished this theory, and he demolished a few animals in the process to demolish this theory. He recorded EEG simultaneously in the brain, not at the surface of the scalp, from the cortex and from the thalamus. And so then, if thalamocortical looping were responsible, if you disrupt the loop in any place, then you should see alpha go away. But damage to the cortex didn't disrupt the alpha rhythmicity in the thalamus. The thalamus still had alpha oscillations if you disrupted the cortex. But damage to the cortex did, or damage to the thalamus disrupted the whole thing. So it would appear that it's not just looping, but the thalamus was driving the EEG alpha rhythmicity. And in other studies by Adrian, he even made what is euphemistically called decorticate preparations, where he removed the cortex of the, I think it was a rat, and you could still see thalamic rhythmicity in that preparation. And it appeared that this was somewhat anatomically specific, so that if one half of the thalamus was lesioned, there was an ipsilateral obliteration of alpha. So the thalamus had ipsilateral driving effects on cortical alpha. So some kinder and gentler studies by the Andersons in the late 60s used functional and reversible lesions by cooling the tissue. So if you cool it, it doesn't work quite so well, and it reduces its efficiency, but it's a temporary lesion if you don't keep it too cooled too long. So this diagram just shows here two things, the frequency of the oscillation and the amplitude of that oscillation. And right here is the onset of cooling, and here is the offset of cooling. And this is cooling of the cortex. And what happens when the cortex is cooled, there's no change in frequency. So whatever's driving it is unaffected, but there's a change in amplitude. The amplitude goes down until the cooling is stopped, and then it returns to baseline. So again, this would just corroborate that it doesn't seem to be the cortex that is driving this alpha rhythmicity, but the cortex is a recipient of it. And in contrast, if you cool the thalamus, you see a little different effect, that as the cooling begins, you see a decrease in the frequency of oscillation both in the thalamus and in the cortex. So they both decrease over time, and then they would return. And the amplitude also decreases in both of them, both in the thalamus and in the cortex. Okay? So the cortex lags a little bit until the driving from the thalamus is really greatly reduced. So this suggests, clearly a role for the thalamus in terms of driving cortical alpha. And there's also sensory-specific alpha driving from the thalamus and alpha blocking from the thalamus, and you can see that, for example, with visual input. So when visual input comes in, then the thalamus driving the occipital cortex is blocked. When visual input is then removed, or the eyes are closed, then the thalamus has specific driving of the occipital cortex for alpha. So the summary from the series of studies by Adrian and the Andersons and others is that the thalamus is driving the alpha rhythmicity of the EEG. And the cortex, of course, provides feedback to the thalamus that might, cause the thalamus then to alter the extent to which it drives the cortical alpha. But the thalamus is still ultimately where the driving of the rhythmicity occurs. And what causes a change from rhythmicity to desynchronization? Desynchronization here just being a term used for alpha blocking. I'll have some more to say about that term next time. Is when there's afferent input coming. So as I mentioned, the example, when visual input comes, then there's going to be a disruption of the thalamic driving. And it's mode specific. So there's visual specificity, there's auditory specificity, and so on. The desynchronization term, I'll just say one more thing about it now, is probably a term that it's a little confusing. initially the idea was when you saw alpha, the EEG was nicely synchronized. Everything was going together. Then when alpha was blocked, everything was kind of messier, appeared to be working a little more independently. So it was desynchronized. But technically it can't be desynchronized or we wouldn't see anything at the surface. Right? It has to be synchronized but at different frequencies than alpha. But when people talk about desynchronization, they may often be talking about something like alpha blocking or theta blocking. Okay. Now, recording EEG, there are a variety of different ways you can do this. You can just use single electrodes. You can use different kinds of stretchy caps or geodesic sensor nets. But they're all going to have to follow some kind of a standardized protocol. And the protocol that we follow is the 1020 system introduced by Jasper in 1958. And this system is illustrated here for the original system. And it involves distances that are 10 or 20% of the inion to nasion distance. So the nasion is just the concavity right here between your eyes. And the inion is a bump on the back of your head. So if you were to move your hand up along your spine and then at the base of the skull, if it's coming up like this, right at that base, there should be a protuberance, and that's your inion. If you have a big inion, the phrenologists would tell you that you're quite affiliative and emotive and generally quite a social and gregarious animal. Right. Now, there's huge individual differences in inion. I don't know of any behavioral correlates that have held up. So once you find this, you measure the distance from the inion to the nasion, and then the central electrode at the midline is 50% of that distance. Okay. The occipital electrodes are 10%. And then the parietal electrodes are another 20% up. So that's why it's called the 10-20 system. The whole thing's put on this grid. The labels are pretty straightforward. F for frontal, C for central, P for parietal, O for occipital, T for temporal. There are odd numbers on the left and even numbers on the right. And if you want to remember that, you can just think that lefties are statistically speaking a bit unusual, so they're kind of odd. So the left side has odd numbers. There are also a couple of leads that are sometimes recorded to be purposely a bit inactive. It can either be the earlobe, which are designated A1 and A2, or the mastoid bone, this big bony protuberance behind the ear, and that would be M1 and M2. There's a lead that's not used that often, CG1. It's a nasopharyngeal lead, sometimes used to get at activity that would be under the brain. So you notice when you look at this, almost all of the leads are on top of the brain. There's very little that comes underneath just the activity that might be visualized there, or if you have something projecting positively up here, it would project negatively down here. On the other hand, I'm not sure many people would be a fan of using the nasopharyngeal lead because it just goes up the nose, as it implies. I'm looking at this from the top. This is the original 1020 system again, and you can just see once more kind of how it's laid out like that. So that was the original system, and at the time it seemed like a lot because most amplifiers only had a few channels. And so to record all of these, you were really a high-tech, state-of-the-art lab. But over the last, 50 years since the 1020 system was introduced, we now have variations of the 1020 system. And so here we see in the dark colors the original 1020 sites, and in the lighter colors sites that have just been interpolated on that same general scheme. So sometimes it's called the 1010 system, I've even seen it called the 105 system, but you get the idea. They're placed, again, and still in terms of these distances. Okay. And this picture is from the chapter by Zigali in the textbook. Okay. Now, all of these systems provide what we hope is a reasonably reliable way of getting a lead at the same spot on the scalp time and time again across subjects, across days. But it's not an anatomically derived system. So there's no guaranteed correspondence. For example, if you're on CZ, are you going to be a little anterior, a little posterior to the central sulcus? There are going to be individual differences in head morphology and brain morphology that mean a given electrode may not really be right over the same piece of cortex in many different subjects. And I first had this kind of aha experience when I was running my dissertation research. And there was this guy, I swear he was from the football team, and his head was kind of shaped like this. And, you know, the 10-20 system, he had the largest Indian-Nasian distance I'd ever seen. It was kind of like Herman Munster. And I realized, you know, that everything is going to be changed for, you know, somebody who's that kind of protuberance at the front. In any event, this is a system that lets you describe how you place things. It's reliable in terms of scalp location, but you can't be guaranteed how it's going to be in terms of actually over brain areas. Now, if people start to integrate imaging technologies, there are ways to know where these line up on a given individual with respect to the actual brain region. So if you were to have somebody come into the lab and you record EEG, you could put little markers right where some of these key sites were. Like, let's say you put one on along the midline at maybe 5 sites and across at 5 sites. And you make it something that would be really bright in the MRI scanner, like a vitamin E capsule that you just kind of glue right to where the goop was on the head. You stick them in the scanner and now you have these bright hot spots where all of these leads were, and now you can actually map exactly where those electrodes were. Yes?
Yeah. So when you do, I've never used electrodes, but it's always systematic, and the placement of them, regardless of, like you were saying, he had a bigger head.
Right, so even if somebody has kind of an alteration to the shape of their head, you would still use the 10-20 system and describe your placements in that way.
So the 10-20
system,
are there any other systems, I guess?
Any other systems? They're all based on some description based upon the original 10-20 system. I mean, there are other, and this is laid out on that. Don Tucker has devised a system that's based upon these geodesic sensor nets. They're all these kind of triangles within triangles within triangles, and it's a way of also placing spots on there, but you can still describe those sites in terms of their approximations of the 10-20 system as well. Now, if you're getting ready to record, you have a variety of options for how to affix different electrodes. You have a variety of options for even, you know, are you going to use electrodes or are you going to use caps? Usually people are going to use silver-silver chloride electrodes, and that's because they're non-polarizing. And so remember, if you have a polarizing electrode, it's going to act as a bit of a capacitor, and that capacitor would be in series with the signal in the recording device, right? Because the signal is generated within the brain. Then up at the surface, if you have this polarizing electrode, you'd have a capacitor, and then there's your recording device. So that would do what? It would filter out some frequencies. Right? And filter out your...
The lowest ones,
right. Mm-hmm. So if you were interested in very slow frequencies, you wouldn't want to use polarizing electrodes. And silver-silver chloride are non-polarizing electrodes, and that's why they're often preferred. Gold electrodes are very conductive, and they're often used in sleep research. And you don't agree with that? That's where I've seen them used. Okay, but gold can be used, but they might be polarizing. On the other hand, we've used tin electrodes. We have some caps that are a little bit on the lower budget side, and they have tin. They're virtually indestructible, and they give pretty decent signals as well. For the electrolyte, you just need to make sure that it's conductive in some way, so it's some kind of ionic solution. Usually these are going to be hypertonic, so they have a saline concentration that's greater than natural human sweat. And then, because it sits on the head, you have to have some way of affixing it. Now, if you have a stretchy cap, the cap kind of holds it in place. But if you're just using individual leads, as you might in a sleep lab, because a cap would get very uncomfortable overnight, or you might, if you're recording infants and you just want to get a couple of sites, then you need something to hold it on. Now, you could use subcutaneous needle electrodes, but most people don't use that for obvious reasons. You just stick it right in underneath the skin. No impedance problem now. collodion has been used. It's not used so much anymore because to get it off required all kinds of nasty chemicals. Collodion is kind of like a second skin, a bandage. In fact, you could use it if you have a bad cut, put collodion over it, sting like crazy, and then you've got this kind of seal right over there. But to get it off, it's like getting off super glue, and you've got to use all kinds of nasty stuff. Sleep researchers used to use that. And you can use some paste. EC2 paste is one version. I have some stuff I brought today when we do our demo 1020 paste. All this is just conductive paste. And you use it, and you stick the electrode on it, and then it sticks. It serves two purposes. It's sticky, and it's conductive. And so it's your all-purpose goop for EEG recording. Okay. And then if you have a lot of sites, you're not going to want to use any of these things. You'll want to use an electrode cap and just insert some ionic, hypersilenic gel inside these little cups. Okay. And so for those of you in the lab, when we come back after spring break and you have your EEG lab, we'll be using EEG caps and we'll be injecting gel into all these little cups. You'll have a chance to do it and you'll have a chance to have it done to you. All right. Now, in terms of recording, one of the things that I don't know has been clear so far, but I want to make explicit, is that when we're recording any kind of a signal, we're recording voltage potential differences. And this goes back to the basic electricity we talked about. We're looking at the voltage potential difference between two locations. So we talk about, well, here's EEG at this site on the head. But it's really EEG at this site on the head compared to some other site. And that other site, whatever you choose, could be very important in terms of what you see. So you have to ask, well, this is the difference between what and what. And people get a bit exercised about what reference to use for various kinds of recording. And I'll just give you an idea here of what the different choices are. So one choice is, are you going to use what's called monopolar or bipolar? Monopolar, in theory, means you have one active and one not active. But if anybody's alive, every site is active. But so mono is in quotes here. But the idea is there's one relatively inactive site and one active site that should have a lot of EEG activity. Bipolar, on the other hand, is two active sites, and they're usually going to be very close in time, okay? Or very close in space. So in terms of relatively monopolar options, the body doesn't have any EEG going on there, so you could use the body, but it's a bad idea because there's all kinds of other stuff going on. You've got EMG, you've got EKG, so you probably don't want to use a reference that's not cephalic. So use some other kinds of cephalic reference. And on the head, a couple of the more common ones are linked ears, linked mastoids, tip of the nose would be three of the most common. The linking of the ears or mastoids is designed to minimize any activity that would be at either. So because of the big bone here on the mastoid and the fact that the ear is even a little further away from any brain activity, you don't get a lot of activity to begin with. And if there's anything that appears positive over here and negative over here, if you average them together, they'll get even closer to an inactive baseline. They can be physically linked. You literally just take a single wire, plug them in, and plug that into your amplifier. Or they can be linked after the fact using digital signal processing, which we'll talk about in another couple weeks. The tip of the nose is not a bad one, except that it also is pretty vulnerable to artifacts from the eyes. As the eyes move, the eyes are polarized, and as they move around, you're going to see blinks and eye movements show up in the reference. And if they're in the reference, they're going to show up in every site, because every site is compared to the reference.
Would you use the ears
The ear you wouldn't get so much. The mastoid, depending, you could get a little bit of EMG in the mastoid. The other thing you have to be careful with the mastoid, so we're looking to go right behind the ear canal on the bone. If you go just a little bit too posterior and inferior, you're going to feel a little heartbeat going on there. Right? There's a draining vein there. And so then you have this subtle change, this physical movement of the electrode, and you'll see that show up in the EEG. So when you get it placed a little bit incorrectly on the mastoid, in every single channel you'll see this little beat that's coincident with the heartbeat. Yes? Well, so the postauricular reflex is a different muscle. It's not linked to the orbicularis, okay? But you can see startle potentiation on this postauricularis muscle, right? It's probably not going to be a problem for most EEG recording unless you're startling your person. Okay, and it's still a pretty small signal. It's not as large as the signal you see here. Okay. So So the reference choice is non-trivial, as it'll change your ability to observe certain signals. And one of the tools that we can use when I show you some signals here is we can re-reference and see what the signal would look like if we chose a different reference. Epileptologists will often change references to try to figure out the location of an epileptic focus. And so if you were to go along the surface of the scalp and you record this one versus this one, and then this one versus this one, this one versus this one, so you're doing pairs as you move along, then you can pick up a spike. If it changes polarity from one to the next, you're pretty close to the location of that spike. So you just look at activity that's not in common to two adjacent sites. Okay. Now, bipolar recording then has multiple active sites, and it's sensitive to differences between electrodes. And so that's what I was just talking about with respect to epilepsy localization, for example. And you can get, you know, very focal fluctuations to be visible in the EEG because it's a differential amplifier. So if you're looking at the activity that's present at one site and not just adjacent to it, there won't be too much that's different. But whatever's different is probably going to be fairly local in its effect, because anything that's coming from pretty far away is going to propagate similarly to the two sites. Okay. Now, you make a choice when you first set up your recording to record online, and then usually after the fact, you have lots of options in terms of re-referencing things offline. And so I mentioned with the mastoids or the ears, you can physically link them, but you can also just take the average of them later. And that's going to be equivalent if you do the average of them later once you've already digitized your data. We'll talk about digital signal processing a bit more later today and still in several lectures later. Another idea that's been used to approximate an inactive reference is the average of all the EEG leads. Okay? And the idea behind this is that if we really were to cover the entire brain, that imagine for a moment that the head is a sphere, and that inside the brain, here's some generator, it's generating an AC signal. So it's going to show up maximally positively here, and a place we usually wouldn't record will show up maximally negatively down here. And then the positivity will get smaller as you go over to the side, and there'll be a little negative here. But if we truly covered the whole head, and we averaged them all together, the sum of all these should approximate zero, because we're covering all sides of this generator. And no matter what the generator is, if we truly cover all sides of this sphere, the average of all the electrodes would sum to zero. So the average reference, if you have really good coverage, could be a great idea. Unfortunately, we usually don't have good coverage below about the level of the ears. And to the extent that we can get coverage down there, there are some caps, like Tucker's caps, that have sites that go down in here. But think about how much artifact you're going to get. You're moving and talking and swallowing, and lots of muscle and EOG. So the average reference does have some problems as well. And any artifacts that are there are going to average in, they're probably not going to average out because they're not coming from inside the brain. Another relatively reference-free solution is one called current source density. I'm not going to say much more about it now. There was a brief blurb in your chapter in the text on this. We'll talk more about it in the advanced topics. Okay. But it's just trying to look at current flow around a given electrode. Okay. Now, no matter how you record, there are artifacts. They're lurking to ruin your data. And you have to minimize them and find them and stomp them out like the Terminex guy. So there's three major sources of artifacts. The first of these is 60 cycle noise, or if you're going to launch your career anywhere outside the northern hemisphere or the very most superior part of South America, it'll be 50 hertz noise, okay? Because this is the frequency of alternating current in these countries. 60 hertz here in North America, a little bit of South America, 50 hertz in the rest of the world. And that noise can be picked up everywhere. And if you don't have a properly grounded device, you can even hear 60 cycle noise. Like on AM radios, you can sometimes pick up 60 cycle noise rather easily. You can really minimize it carefully by grounding the subject, and this isn't an operant conditioning kind of ground the subject.
This is grounding the subject in terms of making sure that they're connected also to the ground of the amplification system. These differential amplifiers that measure voltage differences will also measure the difference from a ground. And so if there's 60 cycle noise that's everywhere, if it's present in the ground, if it's present in, you know, all your signals, it'll be subtracted out. It'll vastly minimize the 60 cycle noise. The other thing you can do is you can use a filter, either online when you're recording the data or after the fact once you've digitized the data to remove this 60 cycle noise. But if you're interested in really high frequencies, you might also remove some of the EEG. So it's best to do your best to minimize it ahead of time. Now, muscle artifact is another problem. It's more of a problem for some sites than for others, but you have all these facial muscles. So if people are talking, if they're chewing gum, if they're yawning, if they're moving their head, there are a variety of things that can cause lots of EMG to show up in your EEG. Sounds simple, but you just ask subjects to remove the gum before they come into the lab. You provide some kind of mechanism where they don't have to really strain their head to keep it in the position you want. You can have a comfortable chair, you can have a chin rest, you can have a head rest, any of those will do. And you might want to measure EMG directly from some muscles using, you know, EMG derivations like we talked about, the frontalis or the temporalis, for example, and try to measure it and at least assess its influence or even try to, you know, see if it accounts for any of your effects. And then eye movements. A lot of times people need to use their eyes when they're participating in our experiments. And as a result, they're moving them and they're blinking. And as I mentioned before, these eyes are charged. They're positive in the front with respect to the back. Every time we blink, we bring this nice, moist, conductive variable resistor across the front of the eye, and we see the eye blink throughout the EEG. You'll see that in a couple of examples that I'll have here shortly. People handle this in different ways. Some people just say, anytime there's a blink, I'm just going to throw out the data, because blinks might produce a signal that could be confused with some EEG. Another idea is some correction. You can try to statistically assess the extent to which this artifact from the eyes is showing up in each EEG site, and then you can try to subtract it out. We'll talk about that in the advanced lecture. And then another thing that people try to do is just control people and say, don't blink. or don't blink while this is on the screen, but blink while this is on the screen. And subjects can be trained to do that, but of course then they have another task to do while they're doing whatever task you want them to be doing. Mm-hmm.
Just a question. Have you seen any differences in people who wear eyeglasses versus contact lenses? Maybe the contacts are
going
to get dry.
Right. They're going to blink more frequently if the contacts are bothering them. I think it depends on how careful they are with their contacts and have they been bothering. But if they're bothering them or they've recently removed them, they can be blinking more. It shouldn't really change anything else about the underlying data, except that now you have either more data to get rid of or more data to correct.
Is this a normal practice to just ask if they think that wear contacts or glasses?
It depends on the interest of your study. So I think if a lab were interested in minimizing the number of blinks, then that would be a good strategy. All right, so maybe it's the time to play that award-winning game. Name that artifact. All right. So I don't expect that some of you will have any idea what these are, but some of you might since you've worked with EEG. So here we have something that seems to show up in every single channel and look almost exactly the same. What? Eye blink? Well, an eye blink would actually not show up in every channel the same. An eye blink would be, it has a decremental conduction. It's going to show up most in the front. And by the time you get to the back, it'll be almost invisible. Gia? Some kind of problem with the reference, right? Because every one of these sites is recorded to the same reference. So if something is present in everything, the most parsimonious interpretation is something happened to the reference. The reference might have moved a little bit. This is a very slow oscillation, but it could be a physical movement, for example, of the reference electrode. Okay, that's good. Now this one you might be able to figure out. It's EMG, that's right. And what might the person be doing?
Rolling over.
Yawning?
Chewing.
Chewing
gum, right. Chomp, 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 chomp. So, you know, there's no excuse if somebody in your lab doesn't notice somebody chewing gum. This ought to be really easy to detect. And gum chewing doesn't automatically show up in red. This was just a segment we marked red because we didn't want it in our data. Okay.
All right, now here we have something that it appears to be that there are three eyesights here. The two right below the eye are showing something in one direction. The one right here is showing something in another direction. And all these frontal sites are also showing changes. But you don't see much in these parietal, temporal, and occipital sites. It's not an eye blink, but you're right. It is an eye movement. And it's an eye roll. And because it's such a smooth roll, the person actually has their eyes shut. And this is actually in a condition where their eyes should be open. I only know that because we code eyes open blocks with odd numbers and eyes closed blocks with even numbers. So they had a nice closed eye roll there during the eyes open condition. Okay. Now, here we have EEG going along, and then there's this burst of something here, and then it goes back to fairly regular looking EEG. So how would you describe this burst? What are its characteristics in terms of amplitude and frequency? High and fast, yeah. So if it's fast, what do you think it is? EMG is the most likely, right. Could be a generalized seizure, but I doubt it. Pretty short, so I would say it's...
A sneeze?
A sneeze would also have a lot of movement artifact. You'd see the channel drift way away. So this is just an EMG muscle burst, and it could come from any number of kinds of things they did. I mean, it could be inhibiting a sneeze, maybe. But it can have too much movement, or you start to see a bunch of sites drift as well. Okay. Let's see what we have here. This was something unusual. I had an RA who wanted to see what all these things looked like, and she did a few unusual things. But what you can see clearly is there's quite a fair amount of EMG, and there's this big ocular deflection. So I think it was some kind of an eye roll and some EMG. I'm not sure. This one was a yawn. And you can see here is a site that just drops right off the chart. So with the yawn, in addition to the EMG, you also get physical movement of leads. And so you can see that. That's, again, a lot of EMG. So you wouldn't want that necessarily. Okay. Oh, I think this one was talking. She was talking as well. So again, you could do some movement and a lot of EMG. Hopefully you'd notice that if you're running a subject. And this is just a big eye blink. It's so big, and it's slow. Big, slow blink, and it goes off the screen. Or actually, it's a big roll of eye movement. It's too slow to get a blink. Okay. And here's what a blink looks like. So we didn't mark this bad. This is a blink. And blinks have a duration of about 300 milliseconds. So they're pretty fast. When people are sleepy, they tend to have a little longer duration, as you might imagine that effect. Here's a triple blink. They just blink three times in a row. But that's what it looks like. And here you notice how it's really focused on these frontal sites. This is the frontal pole 1 and frontal pole 2, FT1 and 2. And you see maybe a little bit of it here at F3 and a little bit here at F4. But by the time you get back to central and temporal sites, it's not present. Okay. So what we'll do here before we take our break is have a demonstration of real live EEG on a willing volunteer. I've set it up in a way that I only have to use Goop on one site. So if that makes a difference, you want to do it? All right. Why don't you come on up? There you go. So once again, we're going to use the same little system that we have. It's not set up to do a lot of EEG work, but it can record a couple of channels. Now, usually I'd use a common reference, but I don't have the right setup for this. So I'm going to have two sites. I'm going to have a frontal site and an occipital site, and I'll have each one referenced to a mastoid. Okay. And so I'll choose one that's FP1 against A1, let's say. And how about O1 against A2? Okay. So I'll have a frontal and a posterior site, each referenced against what we think to be a relatively inactive site. Okay. So
This is new. I brought a six-pack of them. And, you know what? I meant to get some gauze before I came here. You know what we should do? We should take a break early because I need to get my abrasive scrub and the gauze. So why don't we take our break just a little early today, and then we'll come back and do the demo. Okay, so pick up where we left off. Okay. So, as I mentioned before, what I'll be doing is I'll be putting... Oh, the water, yes. I'll be putting a lead on FP1 and reference it to A1, and I'll put a lead on O1 and reference it to A2. This would be an unusual derivation, but it's just one that works given this equipment. Also, I would usually measure her nasion indent distance precisely and place these precisely, but you're not going to learn much by watching me measure things, so I'm going to wing it a little bit just for this demonstration and get them in their approximate location. But don't try this if it were a real study. First, I'm untangling the ground, and we'll apply a ground lead probably just to the middle of the forehead. It's as good a place as any to do this. You've been run before?
Uh-uh.
No? Oh, it's a new experience for you. Not how to care for electrodes. There we go. So just like the EMG, I need to prepare the skin because the skin is going to provide impedance to the signals that come from underneath the skin. And so again, I have that new prep. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to put a ground right here and then a site on F1. So I'm just going to use one time to abrade both regions. I'm going to close your eyes for a second. So once again, I'm just going to stretch the skin a little bit so that I can rub on it and not move it so much. And you tell me if this doesn't feel okay. And just the skin pinkens up a little bit. Pink is good. Red is not good. And then... I would also want to use the same gel for everything if this were an actual recording, but because of the way I have this set up, I'm going to use two different gels here. Just one is a little less viscous than the other. I'm just going to use the sticky gel on the back. So. Does anybody have a paper clip? I feel like Monty Hall. Give me a paper clip. All right. The gel's still fine, but right at the tip here, it's just clogged a bit. I'm just putting a little bit of conductive paste on this silver chloride electrode. And since there's no hair on the forehead, I can just stick these directly on. I'm only going to use the sticky goo in the back. This will be ground here. And this will be FP1 over here. Okay, now I'll also be preparing the mastoid sites in the same way. And the mastoid is right behind the ear. So again, I don't need to use the sticky gel, I'll just use these collars again. By the way, if you work in psychophys lab, it's not a bad idea to have a lab coat, because otherwise you're going to get gels and things on your clothes over time. I'll start over here. So what I'll do is I'm going to locate the bone directly behind the ear canal, and
usually can find a nice flat spot on it, and I don't want to feel a pulse right where I'm going. I mean, I want to feel a pulse if I go down, but I don't want to feel a pulse right here. Okay. Again, tell me if this is uncomfortable for you. Stretch the skin so it doesn't wiggle, so I'm really just abrading the top layer, not just wiggling the skin. And we'll do the same thing on the other side. Do you feel the little grit?
Mm-hmm. Feels like sandpaper.
Yep, that's exactly what it should feel like. Okay. The nice thing about the mastoids, too, is you don't have to worry about most earrings or jewelry because you don't have to remove anything. If you're using the ear clip, you should have to remove jewelry. Okay, so once again, we'll just put these on. So when you're in the lab, as I mentioned, you'll be using a cap. You'll measure the nasal and your distance, and you'll place the cap according to the distance there, and then just fill up the site accordingly. Okay. I'm going to try not to get this on your hair, but it's going to be kind of hard, so you might have a little bit on your hair when you're done.
Okay.
Get the hair out of the way. Sorry.
Sorry.
Okay, there we go. All right, and now, finally, one that gets to use the sticky gel. So, when I ran my dissertation research, I had a 4 EEG lead setup and an ear reference, a linked ear reference. And so I just used a toothbrush to scrub the site on the scalp. That's where I got this toothbrush idea from. And I placed the sites after measuring them and stuck them there with EC toothpaste, which is kind of like 1020 gel. This gives me a little bit of a cup, this electrode does, and then the cup will have this paste in it. So what I'll do is I got this toothbrush. You can get like 6 of them for a buck at the dollar store, and let's see. I'm just going to I'll go right here. Act like a primate and move the hair, and then I just take this brush and just scrub there. And that does the trick. Now again, this shouldn't hurt. Scalps can be kind of tender, so you let me know.
You don't use new prep on the scalp.
I am. I put new prep on the.
Yeah. You can feel it.
Oh, I did. Yeah. Okay, that's on tape too. All right. Okay. Well, it doesn't hurt. We'll be very conductive now. Okay. Good. All right. Does that feel okay?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not going to sign up to have it done regularly. Okay. And then.
Where did you put that?
This one's 01. Yeah. So I want to separate the hair so I can actually see the scalp. And then I take the brush and I just go right on the scalp. And again, the scalp, like the rest of the skin, the top layer is dead skin cells and going to provide a barrier to the signal.
Isn't it hard?
Well, it depends on how thick people's hair is. I mean, for some people it's kind of hard to record EEG. We have one guy who came through our study who still, to this day, is the most famous subject. He has had really, really tough hair to deal with. And he was a really good sport about it. Now this stuff is a real exercise. It's very, very thick. And I just take it and fill the cup and then have enough on the surface that when I put it in there, it'll stick of its own accord. And this is the souvenir you're going to get to take home with you. There's a little bit of goop there. Okay. And I said I would do this one again. This mastoid snap. The ground will go right here. Okay. Well, not bad. I've got three greens and a yellow. So I did a pretty good job. Well, on the yellow, so I'm at 5K ohm, 3K ohm, 4K ohm, and 3K ohm. Usually want 5K ohm or less. So you're either a very good subject or I've got some experience or both. Okay. So now let's remove some paraphernalia and let's take a look at what we can see in terms of the EEG. I'll move this so you can see it as well. What you're going to see on the screen now is the two EEG channels. The green is FP1 and the red is going to be O1. And over here is a real-time spectrum. So it's lagged just a little bit because it has to do some computation, but it shows you where the power is and what frequencies, ranging from 0 to 30 hertz. I can... What? Yeah, the blinks are enormous. So let's see, let's... There we go. I just changed the scale there. And we'll change the scale there. Okay. So the green is up in the front, and every time she blinks, you can just see blink, blink. It's very pronounced every time that she blinks. And the blink shows up as a very slow delta/theta frequency component. So you see it over here, each one blink, blink. Give me a couple of blinks in a row, blink, blink, okay. And you see it showing up as low power here. In fact, it's off the chart, it just reset. Now, if you would, close your eyes and relax. I'm going to hope to see some alpha. There we go, there's the alpha there. Now, I say that and should probably get out of the alpha. So just relax, think, relax, and thought. Generating alpha. I can't see it quite so clearly in the raw waveform here. Sometimes you can. It might just be the display. Actually, now you see it very clearly. Yeah, that was great. You can see that. Oh, go ahead and do that again, whatever you're doing. All right. Just think, relax, think, thought. Beach in Maui. Close your eyes and relax. Let's see if there's a beach in alpha again. It's pretty regular there. You see there? Mm-hmm. That's the alpha in the raw waveform, and you can see it in the spectrum there as well. Now go ahead and open your eyes. And so since you weren't able to see what was happening, every time you closed your eyes, there was a big burst right here in the between 9 and 12 hertz. There was a big spike showing us that you had power in that frequency band. Go ahead and wrinkle your eyebrows like you're angry at somebody. Look what happens. You see all this high frequency activity out here? It's not EEG, but it's EMG that comes in there. Let's see. Probably won't show up too much on these sides, but I want you to clench your jaw shut really tightly. Oh, yeah. Okay. So again, you see it in the raw waveform, and you see it in these higher frequency bands here. Let's see. So blinks we saw very clearly. Would you roll your eyes to the left and look left? Okay, now right. Now left. Now right. Left. Right. Left. Okay. So this has a bit of a filter on it, so she rolls them over there and the signal follows and then it comes back to baseline. That's because it's an AC amplifier and it's filtering out that slow frequency drift. But you can see when she was moving her eyes in staccatic fashion too, you could see the lower frequency activity there as well. So these are pretty sensitive. You can see how dynamic the EEG is over time. But the artifacts can easily obscure the EEG as well. The blink is larger than the EEG, and when she clenched her jaw, the EMG was larger than the EMG. Let's see if there's anything else to show here. Is there anything else you want to try?
Should you do a yawn?
Give us a good yawn. Yeah, there's some EMG and a lot of activity across the higher frequency bands. Mm-hmm. I wish I had a strobe light or something at about 10 hertz. Because, oh, no, seriously, if you have photic driving at a particular frequency, uh-huh. The brain will entrain to that, and you could then see a really pronounced peak at whatever frequency that strobe light
we
were
just
at.
Turn on and off the light.
The low-budget lab. You could probably get up to about maybe a hertz or so with that. Okay. All right. Well, good. I think that's real nice. Anything else? Any questions?
Yes. Just a question of program. Does this thing have any follow feedback as it has like the skin conductance?
No, you know, I tried that out earlier, and I couldn't figure out if any of this does biofeedback, because I don't think this screen allows me to do it. I haven't played with all the different features of this program, but you could easily set it up, though, so that, let's say that any time she had activity in alpha, she got some tone that she finds pleasant, then we could, try to give her feedback on how to increase alpha, for example. Mm-hmm. I did have, I'll show you a study a little bit later today where we did some biofeedback training, and every time somebody blinked, the tones turned off. So they were getting biofeedback based on their brain activity, and when they blinked, the tones turned off. You can do that, too. But this program, I imagine there's a way to do it, but I couldn't find any way to do it. I had myself hooked up earlier, and I couldn't get it to do anything. So.
When you do that, biofeedback, and you're trying to get someone to generate alpha, and you say, would you say just like do whatever you're doing to keep that tone on? Or are you interested in what they're like? Would you then, after the study, how did you do that?
So in classic biofeedback, you just give them feedback based upon the desired physiological state, and not worry about giving them other strategies for how to do it, because then they might be achieving it in some way other than the biofeedback. Ironically, there was one study that looked at EEG asymmetry biofeedback, and the theory would suggest, happy thoughts should move it one way and sad thoughts should move it another way. And one group was uninstructed, and they were able to show some effects. One group was instructed, and they didn't show any effects. So the instructions actually interfered with the natural biofeedback in that case. And it may be that, people just figure out something through trial and error with respect to the tones.
Is there research on, after someone's done biofeedback, then asking them what they did,
mm-hmm.
and what did they do?
Right. I don't know, but systematically, we asked our subjects. Most of them said they weren't sure. So it may be that for some kinds of biofeedback, people have a pretty clear sense of what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought of a relaxing scene. I pictured myself on a beach, something like that. But for other kinds of biofeedback, they may not be as clear. Hmm? Want to change the tape? It's probably a good time to disconnect our subject. Thank you
mm-hmm.
for your willingness to do this. So let me just pause this. For the sleep researchers in the crowd. Okay. Sorry if that hurt. I don't know if you like your band-aid taken off quickly or slowly. Okay. That one hurt the hair, so I apologize. Had the hair, I guess
had
I should
hair,
say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now this one has the goop. Yep, it was just a gel. In fact, let me pass the gel around. You can take a look at it in case you're curious. I'll warn you, though, if you get any out, it's going to be everywhere. So. What's that? The forehead was just standard electrode cream.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And usually I would use the same paste everywhere, but just because of the setup I had here. I have an extra gauze pad here. Let me send you home with it. So you can have a gauze pad to wipe your forehead. And acids. Okay. And hang on 1 second. I'm going to get this little bit of... Okay, there you go. Thank you. By the way, since we've done these recordings on all these different signals, I'd just be curious if you think to note on your 3x5 card how much you like, you know, taking the time from class to do this, just let me know. All right. So, we're set for the video? Okay. So, now I want to talk, so we've talked about the physiological basis for the signal. We've talked about some of the setup in terms of, you know, how we would connect the electrodes and some of the settings that we would have. Now we'll talk about some of the actual recording settings, the things that we would be changing on our amplifiers and as we digitize the signal. So EEG is going to be in a frequency range from somewhere about 1 hertz for delta, maybe even a half a hertz for some very slow components we might be interested in response to certain stimuli, all the way up to, say, 50 hertz if you're interested in gamma activity. So we might want to have frequencies in there. But we usually filter out the very slowest frequencies because it provides a drift. So you saw when she moved her eyes, the system brought it right back to baseline. And that's because it had a high pass filter setting. On older systems, it's also called a time constant. And you're familiar with time constants in capacitors. And so if you're using an older system like a Grass polygraph, or a Beckman dynograph, these things are expressed in terms of time constants, and some of the newer older systems are expressed in terms of filters, and the newest systems are all expressed in terms of filters. But if you ever see a polygraph, you know, you get some equipment from a friend because you're just starting up and you want to run a study, and you say, okay, I really want to filter things out that are slower than a half a hertz, and then keep things up to 30 hertz, and all it has is time constants, then this slide will be invaluable. Otherwise, it will just go into the historical waste bin. The time constant in seconds can be converted to a frequency setting. So if you wanted to keep things from about 1/2 hertz on up, you'd use a 0.3-second time constant. And the time constant can be converted to frequency just by this handy formula here. As I said, most of the newer systems, you would just directly dial in the cut point for the high-pass filter. But on the older systems, you'd find a time constant. And if you chose this wrong, you could filter out all your signals of interest. Like if you're interested in alpha and you chose a 0.01-second time constant, it'd be gone. You wouldn't have any alpha. Okay. So here is an old Grass polygraph. This is a Model 7. And to appreciate, you know, this thing is probably about as tall as I am. And each one of these things is a, you know, like a 4U rack mount space. It takes up a good chunk of real estate, probably 6 inches tall or so. And each one is a channel. And all those knobs and buttons are there to intimidate the novice and to allow you to have settings, you have filtering and amplification and so on. On these older systems then, they did have wires that could go out to a computer, but they also would write here on the chart paper, so you could actually see it go by as it went on. And with EEG and EMG in particular, this old chart paper, as the pens would go, these are pens not in the sense of like a thick pen, but they're long arms with a stylus that comes down, and there's an ink well and a little tube that goes up. And so it draws the ink out. And as they go, they spray ink when they're going rather fast. And so when somebody makes a muscle grimace or a yawn, all the pens together will go. And if you're standing there without your lab coat, there's ink everywhere. And so this looks old, but this is a very clean polygraph because they would often get very dirty from the spraying of the ink. So you'd dial in your filter settings and you'd choose channel by channel what's the high pass and what's the low pass filter setting. And of course now you just do this. You know, here's the new model. This thing is about the size of your textbook for reference. Okay, that's about as tall as your textbook. And it has 64 channels in this device. And you just set everything using a computer interface. You'd say, here I want to look at things that go between 0.15 hertz and 200 hertz. And that can even be set differently for different channels on a system like this. Okay. So it certainly is a lot simpler. And then once you save a setup file, if you don't alter it, it's guaranteed to be the same for each subject. Whereas with the old Grass polygraph, every time you had to look at every channel and make sure that each one was set correctly.
I'm just curious, so one that you just showed with it, they had this big, huge,
mm-hmm.
like each panel was.
They had
a smaller.
Probably had the Model 12, right, where each one might be about the size of a small book.
Right, and mm-hmm. you still had to like switch the dial mm-hmm. for like the filter.
Right. So when you go into the lab next time, you'll look, and adjacent to all the equipment that you've been using is a Model 12 polygraph. It's 32 channels, and each one of those things is about maybe an inch and a half tall. And every channel can be independently controlled for filter settings, or conveniently on that model, there's an all-channel control, meaning if you put all the every channel you want to be the same on all channels, then at the very bottom, there's an extra one. And whatever you set that one to, anyone that's dialed into all channel takes that setting. So it was a little bit easier.
This just like bypasses all that and
yes.
manually set the filters on this.
Right. So this is all a digital amplifier. In fact, there's no A to D card. There's no analog output from this thing at all. Everything happens inside this box, and then it's sent by a USB cable into your computer. So it's doing all the work of that huge graph polygraph and a computer that would do the digitization. And it just sends it over the USB wire to the software. And this software then communicates back across the wire to have things like, you know, how much amplification do you have, and what are your filter settings, and, for example, a notch filter here would filter out 60 cycle noise or 50 cycle noise, depending on which one you had, you know, where you were. You can use AC or DC recording mode, so all these settings are right here.
And you usually wouldn't want to use a notch filter if you're interested. You just
want to
make sure you have good ground.
Right, right. Now, as we'll talk about later, if you don't sample very quickly and you don't have a notch filter, you can run into some problems in that you'll have aliasing, okay? And if you don't know what that is now, that'll make sense in a little bit. So you might have to use a notch filter if you were a little bit worried about a slow sample rate and not a good connection. But if you can get a good ground and every site, you know, well prepared, then that shouldn't be an issue. You can always filter it out after the fact. With a digital filter. And digital filters are usually going to allow you to be more precise. They can work offline than the analog filters that you use online.
So what circumstances would you want to use an online?
Well, a lot of those circumstances are no longer valid, but you're sampling data, for example here, 1,000 times per second times 64 channels, so you have 64,000 data points per second. And on today's computer, they handle that fine, the rate of it, and the hard drives are large, they handle that just fine. But even 15 years ago, it was not the case that you could just sample like that. You'd really have to think carefully about how much hard drive space you had, how many things you wanted to put to tape and get back off tape, or burn to CD and get back off CD. And in the sleep lab, it was particularly thorny because you'd be recording for 8 hours at a time. Right. So then you might say, well, I'm going to take my A to D rate way down. What's the fastest thing I need to acquire during sleep? Maybe some EMG here. Let's say I can even get it at 70 hertz. So I'll sample at a couple hundred hertz for the night. And then you might want to think you'll have to set your filter settings accordingly so you don't have anything too fast to be sampled. All right. So this just shows another way of looking at frequency. So you want to choose settings that make sense. You don't want to eliminate the frequencies of interest. And what I did here, this was with an old graph polygraph, and I sent a signal in that was white noise at a white noise generator. And white noise is, if it weren't filtered, every frequency would be equally represented. Okay. Well, given enough time, I mean, on any given segment of time, one will be a little higher, but. It's a random distribution, a rectangular distribution. It's an equal chance that any frequency will be represented. And I ran it through the polygraph, and you can see there was obviously a high-pass filter because the very slowest signals here weren't passed. This is power as a function of frequency. And the very fastest frequencies weren't passed. This had a 30 hertz half-amplitude filter, so signals at 30 hertz are about half their original amplitude. But filters don't just stop there. They have these kind of broad roll-off characteristics so that some signals that are less than the stated cutoff are already being attenuated, and some frequencies beyond the stated cutoff are still passing. So you have to make allowances for that. You can see this also had a 60 hertz notch filter that really did a good job. You can see how flat that is right there, so it just notched it right out. And your filter settings, you have to choose being mindful of your digitization rate. The short story here is you need to make sure that no signals are passing that are greater than one-half your sampling rate. If they're greater than one-half your sampling rate, you run into trouble. That trouble is known as aliasing. We'll talk about it in detail in a minute. Okay. So now let's talk about digital signal acquisition. Do you want to see that again?
Yeah. Sorry, to know then how much bigger than your sampling.
Okay, so the fastest frequency you can capture is 1/2 your sampling rate.
Okay.
Okay. So you can't have any frequencies faster than 1/2 your sampling rate. If you do, there's potentially some trouble. Okay, so now let's talk about digital signal acquisition. And to appreciate this, I need to draw a distinction between analog signals and digital signals. So analog signals are continuously varying signals in time and in amplitude. Okay. So there's no arbitrary division of time, and there's no arbitrary division of amplitude. It's continuous. So if this were my signal here, if I had a sample point here, I know exactly what time it is and what voltage it is. No matter how far the distance, if I want to go 0.1 seconds, 0.11 seconds, 0.111 seconds, 0.11111 seconds, I can go exactly that amount and find the exact voltage that's there. Okay? And so analog signals are continuously varying in time and in voltage. But it's not a very efficient system if you're going to digitize, because a lot of the information is redundant. Adjacent points are very similar to each other. So discrete time signals then have discrete time points on the x-axis, but the full range of values in the amplitude domain. And so what that would look like is now I still have infinite resolution on the y-axis, but based on whatever rate I've chosen, I have a data point here, a data point here, a data point here, a data point here. So my signal is really a connect the dots kind of signal now. But the y-axis still can be any value. It could go from, you know, 0.15 microvolts to 0.151 microvolts to 0.15111 microvolts. There's no restraint on that. And that's a discrete time signal. So now we've reduced some of the information we have to store, because we're simply taking points that are closely spaced in time, and hopefully we're not losing any information. There's not some kind of real wacky feature that erupts, emits, and stabilizes in between two data points. Right? If it did, we'd miss it. So you choose your sample rate with that in mind. And then, finally, digital signals are going to have discrete time points like the discrete time point signals, but they're also going to make the y-axis a series of discrete values as well. Okay? And so, and the discrete time points, actually, sorry, on the y-axis are represented as a limited range of values. So that should be y, not x. So in the good old days, we had 12-bit converters. CDs are often 16-bit converters. You can have 32-bit converters, 64-bit converters. They all happen to be powers of 2, which is convenient for a variety of reasons. So if we go back to the ELMO then, and look at this, so now what we have is, in addition, we have bins. So if this data point falls in this bin, it gets the value. And if it's a little bigger or a little smaller, but it still falls in the bin, it all gets the same value. Same thing here, same thing here. So now, two adjacent points, if they're close enough together in terms of their amplitude, would get the same digital value here. So you need to have enough resolution that these are pretty close together so that you don't end up getting, you know, a lot of flatness in your waveform, because you're missing meaningful variation. So if we had a waveform like this, and our digital values were here, okay, and our time points sampling were here, let's say, then we'd have a data point here, and it gets this value. A data point here gets this value. Data point here gets this value. Data point here gets this value, and so on, until finally this data point exceeds the threshold, and now we have a bunch of same data points there, and then when we see that threshold, we get a bunch of data points here. So our new waveform, our sampled waveform, looks really crappy. Right? It doesn't look anything like the original waveform, because we don't have enough resolution in this y dimension.
So the value is the midpoint of the bin, right?
Yeah, well, it's just going to be a single number for the entire bin, and I'm just drawing as if it's the midpoint.
But is it going to be the average of what they would really be?
No, it's just a mapping scheme. So this is going to be some power of 2. So let's say this goes from, it'll be 2 to the third, or 8 bins. Okay, so the first bin is 0, the next bin is 1, the next bin is 2, the next bin is 3, and so on.
Okay. So it has nothing
and then later on, we do a translation back to microvolts, right? But it would, for all intents and purposes, you can think of it as the midpoint once you do the translation back. So you have a scaling that converts 0 back to the mean and 1 back to
so
some other value.
It's not affected where it is in the bin by what those values are.
No, okay. Everything within a bin is treated exactly the same. So you don't want really large bins, or you're going to have very crummy sound. Okay. Now, the telephone system used to run entirely on an 8-bit system. So you can think about, you know, what the sound quality of telephones is compared to, say, even the internet, right? Or compared to, you know, somebody in the room with you. You lose a lot of information with an 8-bit conversion. You still understand most people, right? But it just doesn't sound like it has a lot of subtlety to it because you're losing information. The full spectrum of the voice is not represented when you have just a small conversion. So 8 bits would be 2 to the 8th or 256 values to cover the whole range. Okay. Now, a 12-bit converter or more is usually going to be adequate for EEG purposes. So now digital amps will do this all internally, but if you have an external amp and you plug it into your computer, you may have what's called an A to D card, an analog to digital card, or an analog to digital converter. And this then converts that analog signal into some digital representation where you have a fixed number of points on the x-axis, a sample rate, and a fixed number of y points, that is the how many bits the converter has, 2 to that number. Now, there's an old device that's the world's simplest A to D converter, and this device is known as a Schmitt trigger. These things are actually kind of useful for a limited range of things. Okay, so the old Schmitt trigger is a device that allows you within some range here, this would be the range of the signal, to set a threshold. So this is going to be our threshold, and anytime the signal crosses it, the Schmitt trigger turns on, sends out voltage. Anytime it doesn't, it turns off. It doesn't send out voltage. So your original signal could be, what comes out of the Schmitt trigger is nothing, 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 signal, nothing, 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 signal. Okay? So it loses all that other information. It's a great way, though, to detect some major event. So you can imagine that you've got an optical sensor and it's going across a doorway. And there's noise because, you know, there's light fluctuations and, you know, somebody comes walking by with a big magnet and all kinds of things. But what you really care about is when that light is disrupted. Right? So your cat runs outside, and you don't want your cat to run outside. And so as soon as that signal changes, there's a big event, and that big event is detected. The voltage goes out and drives some kind of an alarm. Right? Or you could think about the invisible fence this way as well, right, for dogs. So, you know, there's a bunch of noise, the collar's picking up, but it's not enough to cross the threshold. When the dog gets close to that thing, it changes the signal, and it's a dichotomous event. You don't want your dog getting gradations of shock as it goes near the thing. You just want nothing, 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 and boom, you've hit the invisible fence line. Okay. So Schmitt triggers, you know, are fairly useful, and they're just a very, very simple A to D converter. It's a 1-bit converter. It's 2 to the 1, or 1 value. It's 0 or 1, right? That's all you get. Now, obviously that wouldn't be adequate for EEG, EKG, EMG, any of that stuff. We need to have much more. Now, the A to D converter then involves converting all these different channels and then using a fixed number of values to represent the signal. So 12-bit converters allow 2 to the 12th. That was a superscript this morning. 2 to the 12th, which would equal 4,096 values. And 16-bit converters to the 16th, or 65,536 values. Okay. That's a lot of values. In terms of the time dimension, A to D converters have to work pretty quickly, because if you're sampling at 1,000 hertz, that means 1,000 times a second it has to read what the signal is and convert it to a value and write it out.
And if you have 64 channels, then that's 64 times 1,000 or 64,000 times a second. It does that. A subtlety that I'll just make you aware of here is if timing is really, really, really critical, you might need to know how your system multiplexes. So if I need to sample 1,000, let's do something simple. Let's say I'm going to sample 100 times a second, okay, and I have 10 channels. So I have to get 1,000 samples in that entire second. There would be two ways to do it. The first way would be to divide the second into 1,000 bins and then just get a sample at every bin. But that means that my first channel, my 10th sample channel, are sampled at a slightly different time, right? Because it's going to go through and sample channel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And if I'm sampling at 100 hertz and 10 channels, that means there's going to be 10 milliseconds difference between my first and my last channel. Okay. So that's probably not acceptable for some purposes. It's probably fine for others, depending what you're sampling. Now, that's the way that the cheaper cards would work. They just divide your sample rate and your channels up, and they divide the whole time into equally spaced bins. But there are also burst mode A to D converters where they can go, let's say they can go at 20,000 hertz. That's their maximum rate. And what they do is, I got 10 channels, I go at 20,000 hertz for 10 channels, and then I wait. And then 20,000 hertz equivalent, and I wait. So you get this burst. So now the difference between the first and the last is 10 20,000. So it's a tiny number, right? And then there's a bunch of wait times. So most of the time, it's actually waiting around and takes these things in. So either way, then, what you're going to get is for every channel, just a vector that's a bunch of samples, and each one of those data points comes at an interval that is the sample rate. Now, in terms of the resolution, the number of bits you have in your A to D converter may or may not be adequate depending on how much you amplify the signal. Okay? And this is just an example using some values from a graph polygraph. So 4,096 values, that would be 2 to the 12th, would allow one value for each 0.02 microvolts. So if something differs by less than 0.02 microvolts, then it would get the same number. Okay? That's pretty small. But that would be if you're amplifying the signal 20,000 times. And so in this example, you can see that 2.1130 microvolts and 2.1131 microvolts would be the same number of digital units, but 2.1250 would actually give you a different number of digital units. So this is just a demonstration of 12 bits is adequate for this particular setup. Most of the stuff you'd buy commercially, somebody's taken the time to figure this out, but I'd be wary. If you're buying a 12-bit converter, let's look at the amplification that you have. If you're buying a 16-bit converter, you've got so many values, you're probably okay. Okay, so this A to D conversion is either intuitive or not intuitive, depending who you are and how much you like this stuff. So I have just a different way to look at it. This comes from the book The Way Things Work. It's a great coffee table kind of book and shows you how all kinds of things work. You can find how laser printers work and automatic transmissions work. And this is how digital recording works. And he always uses little animals in this. He's got a cat and some rats and stuff. He's got elephants and other ones. And this is hopefully a recapitulation of what I've talked about now in terms of digital signal acquisition. So you can see he's got a bunch of cats singing away over here. And this cat's listening to the whole thing over here. And whatever it is they're singing produces a waveform. And that's what this analog waveform is. So if you were recording on old, cassette tapes, you have an analog signal. It's continuously varying in time and continuously varying in voltage. The trouble with those signals is any bit of noise can screw up the signal. And you play it a lot and you start to, have some wear and tear on the tape. Or with old phonograph records, you have to get some crud in there. The signal changes over time. With digital signal recording, it's much more impervious to that. So now if we overlay a grid on the signal, this is a grid like I was drawing on the overhead, we have discrete points in time where we're going to take a sample, and we have a discrete number of values. So this is a 3-bit converter. It's 2 to the 3rd, or 8 values.
And because it's a digital world, it goes from 0 to 7 instead of 1 to 8. Okay. And so this is the signal that's there, and then each one of these things is converted to a digital value. So this is 010, which we would know is the value 2. This is 100, we would know is the value 4, and so on. So that's just binary down there. And then each one of those is now a series of zeros and ones. That's what the binary representation is. So you have a 3-bit converter, you have 3 bits per data point. You have a 12-bit converter, you have 12 bits per data point. 16-bit converter, 16 bits per data point. So obviously having a bigger bit converter is also going to increase your storage requirement. And then on some kind of digital media, it could be a CD, could be a digital tape, could be your hard drive, these zeros and ones are coded as very different from each other. They can be 0 or 5 volts, they can be, you know, high and low pox in a CD, so that over time any kind of noise is unlikely to change the ability of the system to read this is a 0 and this is a 1, because these are clearly different than each other, as opposed to the analog recording where, you know, there's small differences here. And so then you have this series of zeros and ones, and if your device then knows sample rate and the number of bits, it can completely reconstruct the sampled signal. It goes through here and says, okay, I've got, you know, three bits, so that's going to have 3 bits, and this is the first sample, second sample, third sample, fourth sample, taking 3 at a time, and knowing the sample rate, plot it out on an x-axis, and you have your digital signal. So if you've seen, if you go back and get oldies, you can sometimes see that this was AAD. It was analog at recording, analog at processing, and then it was finally put on digital at the end. You know, and the new stuff's DDD. Okay? You can do that stuff in your own home now with digital signal processing boards at home. But you know, some of the oldest stuff would be ADD, which means it started out being recorded analog, then they did digital remastering, and then they did digital cutting of it on a CD or a DVD. Okay, so before we talk about the problem of aliasing, let me just see, is this clear, digital signal acquisition? And if you do this right, your increments in time are small enough, and your increments in the y-axis are small enough that you don't lose any meaningful part of the signal. And this is where audiophiles get really hung up about the number of bits and the sampling rate for CDs. So true audiophiles will say, well, CDs will never sound like the real thing. And their claim is that by taking 16 bits and 44 kilohertz sampling rate, you're still not going to get all the subtleties that they perceive as essential to the signal. And the whole degradation problem gets worse when we think about the way most of us listen to music, iPods and, you know, computer compressed streams. There's a lot of loss of information there. But for most intents and purposes, it's still acceptable to most people. Okay, so now let's talk about the problem of aliasing. This is a problem when you don't know your signal well enough. You haven't become acquainted with your signal, and you've made some decisions about signal acquisition that are unfortunate. And this was first illustrated by Harry Nyquist. He was an engineer working, I think it was for Bell Labs, and this was in the 20s. And he put forth the proposition that in order to properly represent a signal, you have to sample at a fast enough rate, and that rate that he stated in 1928 is twice as fast as the highest signal frequency present. Okay. So you can only capture things that are half the sampling rate. Anything higher than that, you won't be able to capture. Okay. So stated differently, the highest frequency which can be absolutely accurately represented is one half the sampling rate. Okay. So that would be the Nyquist frequency. So we're sampling at 1,000 hertz, our Nyquist frequency is 500. That's probably not a problem for EEG. Could be a problem for EMG. Okay. And so this has become known as the Nyquist frequency, and equals half the sampling rate. Now, a couple of comments. Even if I'm sampling it at, let's say, 100 hertz, and I have a 50 hertz signal, I'll be able to capture the frequency, but the waveform itself may look distorted. And I'll draw just to show that. So, unless I'm really, really lucky. So here's my signal, my 50 hertz signal. And the first case will be the lucky case. I'm sampling at 100 hertz, meaning I'll sample twice per period of the waveform. And let's think of this as a cosine wave. So this is the start, and there's the start again. Okay? So I sample here and here.
And now the next cycle, here and here. And the next cycle, here and here. My waveform looks great. I connect it and it's beautiful. It's a little triangular, but it has the full amplitude. Most likely, though, I'm not going to be quite so lucky. And I'll sample here and here. And here and here. And here and here. So now my waveform has the right frequency, but its amplitude appears to be diminished a bit. So as things get close to the Nyquist, we may actually distort their amplitude a bit for reasons that are kind of capricious. We just don't happen to line up our samples with the peaks and the troughs exactly. So although you won't run into any problems in representing signals inaccurately or representing signals that aren't there, if you sample properly, you still want to probably have your highest frequency be substantially lower than half your sampling rate for this reason. But no matter what, any frequency that's faster than the Nyquist frequency can't be adequately represented. There's just no way to do it. The minimum sampling rate for a given frequency is known as the Nyquist sampling rate. So if I have a 100 Hz sampling rate, my Nyquist frequency is 50 Hz. If I have a 50 Hz signal, my Nyquist sampling rate is 100. It's just double. Usually people think about the Nyquist frequency as the signal, but you can also think about it in terms of the sampling rate. Okay, so, yes? If the sampling frequency is not high enough, but let's say we don't have any aliasing, so we still, the highest frequency present is only half the sampling rate. But as we get close to the Nyquist, there's a good chance that the signal could in fact be a bit attenuated, as I illustrated here. So that if we're not catching it right at the peak in the trough, it'll appear to have a diminished amplitude. So we'd want to be careful for any signals, interpreting amplitude for signals that are very close to the Nyquist. Well, if we're far enough away from the Nyquist, then it probably wouldn't make a lot of difference. So let's say we sample, in our lucky case, we sample here, 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 here. We catch the peak exactly, right? We got all these samples. In our unlucky case, we here, 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 here. We just skip the trough, right? Here, 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 here. And for whatever reason, we're just a multiple of it. We just skip the peak. So we're rounding it ever so slightly. But if we're that far away from the Nyquist, then the resultant difference between hitting it exactly at the peak and just a little off the peak isn't going to be practically important. Okay, so now the problem of aliasing. So any frequency above your Nyquist frequency is going to appear to be a frequency lower than the Nyquist frequency. And so it will appear to be something it's not. It will have a new name. It's been aliased. So if my Nyquist frequency is 50 Hz, and I have 60 cycle noise coming in, it's going to show up as 40 Hz. And I'll tell you how to figure out that exact amount in a minute. So 100 Hz sampling rate would probably be an unfortunate sampling rate, just because 60 cycle noise is going to be hard to get rid of entirely. So you're going to have 60 cycle noise. That 60 cycle noise is going to be higher than your Nyquist. It's going to show up as 40 Hz activity. Now let's say you have a great hypothesis about gamma activity or something, and you think gamma activity and consciousness, and you publish this great paper, and what you've really found is 60 cycle noise has been aliased down to 40 Hz. So you want to think about sampling rates that are clearly higher and aren't going to get you into those kinds of troubles. Okay. So the Nyquist frequency plus X Hz will actually be seen as that Nyquist frequency minus X Hz. And that works really well until you get down to zero. So if our Nyquist frequency is 100, well, 99 is 49 above, so it'll be seen as 1 Hz. Now 100, that's twice, and that'll be seen as 0 Hz. But now 101, that can't be seen as a negative 1, so it'll come back up to 1. And then 102, it comes back up to 2. It goes out there till 150, at which point then it goes back down to 1, then it goes back up. So it's this kind of accordion folding, and that's shown here. But it's kind of
a little counterintuitive, but let me just walk you through it. So this is the actual So here's our Nyquist frequency here, and from zero to the Nyquist frequency, the signal is represented as zero to the Nyquist frequency. Okay, this is sample rate over two. So zero is represented as zero, signal is represented here, all the way to the Nyquist frequency, which is represented properly. Then, as you go above the Nyquist frequency here, then you start going back down towards zero until you're at twice the Nyquist, until you're up at the Nyquist sampling rate, or twice the Nyquist frequency. Then you go back up again, and then back down, then back up, then back down. That would just keep on going again and again and again. So you could figure out if there's an artifact of a given frequency, knowing this accordion-like folding, you could figure out what frequency it would possibly alias as.
Why? I don't see why you see it. There and it has to show up somehow.
Yes, and I'll show you that. Actually, that's what this diagram is designed to show in a couple of simulations that I have.
Okay.
So here we have a cosine wave of frequency f. That's the solid line. Okay. And it's sampled at its Nyquist frequency, twice its frequency, right? Here's its peak, drop, peak, drop, peak, drop. Okay. There'd be no misrepresentation of that signal at all. Now we have a higher frequency dotted line and a lower frequency dashed line. So the higher frequency is peaking and troughing more frequently, right? And the lower frequency is peaking and troughing less frequently. They are also sampled at the same rate. So here's the first point. Look what happens at the next point. This frequency that is above the Nyquist and this frequency that's the same amount below the Nyquist end up getting the same sample point. Same thing here. Same thing here. Same thing here. Okay? So it's, you have to sample the data, but you're missing, there are peaks and troughs that are occurring that you're missing, so it's going to look like a slower signal. And then this is just one more demonstration to I think make it even a little clearer. So here I have a 10 hertz sampling rate for three signals. So here's a signal that's 1.25 hertz. And a slightly slower signal that's 1 hertz, and a slightly faster signal that's almost invisible that's 1.5 hertz. It's in purple here. Can you see that in the back? Can you drop the lights for just a second?
There you go.
Okay. I thought purple was such a nice color, but it just didn't really do so well. Okay. So at 10 hertz, they all look fine, right? And because the Nyquist frequency sampling at 10 hertz is 5 hertz, and these are nowhere near the Nyquist frequency, so they all look great. But now let's assume that I'll cut my sampling rate by a factor of 4 and go to a 2.5 hertz sampling rate. So my effective data sample points are here, 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 and here. And this just shows what happened with the other diagram, that now at 2.5 hertz, the Nyquist frequency is 1.25 hertz. And I'll catch it at its peak and its trough, its peak, its trough, its peak, and so on. 1 hertz I'll also be able to see, but 1.5 hertz is now above the Nyquist, and it's 0.25 hertz above the Nyquist, and so it's going to look like a signal is 0.25 hertz below the Nyquist. And you see again, the red and the green, or the purple and the green match up every time. Well, I drew my line a little. Oh, there, purple and green, purple and green, purple and green. So if I then take away all the data points other than the ones I've just sampled, here's my Nyquist frequency waveform. Here's my 1 hertz waveform. And here's my faster waveform. It lies right on top of it. It's indistinguishable. So aliasing is clearly a problem. So we can probably have the lights again. Yeah. So aliasing could also happen if you were sampling sound. You didn't sample fast enough. Higher frequencies would sound like lower frequencies. It probably wouldn't sound very good either. Okay. So there's a few solutions to aliasing. Sample really fast. Filter appropriately so you get rid of signals prior to digitization that are too fast. You do something called anti-aliasing thickeners, filters. And I think the number one suggestion is know the characteristics of your signal. What frequencies are you interested in? What frequencies are likely to be there, both in your signal and any potential artifacts? And then set your filters and your digitization rate accordingly. All right, so now we have a digital signal, and there are different ways to take a look at it. We can look at it in terms of voltage as a function of time, which we've seen so far, but we can also look at it in terms of power as a function of frequency, and we saw that a little bit during the demo today, so we could see those spectral plots over on the right side of the there. So time domain analysis just takes a look at this voltage as a function of time. And we're familiar with this, like skin conductance response. You look at, you know, amplitude as a function of time. You look at the latency of the response, for example. The event-related potential is another example of a time domain analysis. And so latency and amplitude are really, you know, key kinds of variables for this. And we'll talk more about that in another lecture or two. So frequency domain analysis, though, involves taking a signal and trying to characterize it in terms of what frequencies are actually present. And any given signal likely has a lot of different frequencies, and we try to, you know, characterize it in terms of those constituent frequencies. And there are a few assumptions of this method that, if not met, will again cause trouble. There's all kinds of ways to encounter trouble with this. You just have to know what the assumptions are and make sure that they're met. So the first thing is that this technique, known as Fourier analysis, assumes that your signal is periodic. And by periodic, we mean it's repetitive, and, moreover, repetitive is not enough. It's that repetition occurs at uniformly spaced intervals. Okay? So in one sense, you could say the EKG is repetitive. But as we've seen, those intervals are not uniformly spaced. Okay? So the EKG is not a periodic waveform. But alpha rhythm, potentially, could be a periodic waveform. We see at 8 hertz, let's say, then every peak comes, you know, 1/8 of a second apart. Okay, and it's assumed, for reasons I'm not entirely clear on, but you'll see the consequence of, that it's assumed to persist from infinite past to infinite future. But another way of saying this is that if we took the sample of data we have, then we could assume that it would occur again right after, and it would have occurred again right beforehand. And if it doesn't, then it's technically not a periodic signal. So potentially a problem in some instances. So let's say this is our signal. That's beautifully periodic because this point right here would be the start of the whole thing again. So then, you know, just continue on. Looks great. If we take the same signal, we just don't have quite as much of it. Now, if we were to assume that it starts again here, and then starts again here, it wouldn't look right if we connected the dots. Right? So that doesn't look like a periodic signal. We have to do some things that I'll tell you about in a moment to take care of that. Okay. So here's the basic idea, that any complex wave actually can be decomposed into a bunch of simpler waveforms that are a single frequency. In this example, we have a slow wave here, a moderately fast wave here, and then here's a wave that probably has a couple of frequencies in it here. And if you superimpose all of them, which is just summing them, add them up, you get a complex waveform like this. And the sound that we hear all the time is a complex waveform, not unlike this. There's a fundamental frequency, and then there are harmonics, so that, you know, you can hear the fundamental pitch, but also the character that comes through with all of those different harmonics. So, like, you know, a trumpet has a lot of higher frequencies compared to, say, a baritone or a tuba or a bassoon. Our ears do kind of a job of this, decomposing frequencies all the time. We don't have to think about it. We don't have to do Fourier transforms on it. But computers will take care of this problem in terms of Fourier transforms. So the Fourier series representation of the signal, then, is that if a signal is periodic, then it can be expressed as the sum of sine and cosine waves of different amplitudes and different frequencies. And it's just the Fourier series representation of a signal. We've seen a little bit of that already using the demonstration JNJ software here. So conceptually, you can think of it this way. This is not mathematically precise, but it's designed to just think about it. So that our signal, x is a function of t, it's a vector, it's a row of different sample points, is going to equal a bunch of different frequencies, and for each frequency there's going to be some phase, like where in the cycle did it begin? Did it start at the beginning of the cycle, 90 degrees, 180 degrees, 270 degrees into the cycle? And then there's going to be an amplitude for a cosine and sine wave function. So we're decomposing the signal to a bunch of sine and cosine waves, and they vary in terms of where they begin. So, once again, back to the ELMO. To see something like that, if we took, there's a cosine wave of one amplitude, and we could do that same cosine wave of the same amplitude, but we could have it be this, which that would be starting at phase 0. This would be starting at phase 270, for example, if you think of 0, 90, 180, 270, 360. So the waveform could start at any point. Okay? And so it's going to start at some point, and then it has a certain amplitude, and that's for the duration of the sample that you have. And you'll have lots of different frequencies. If there'd be another frequency, it would start at its own phase, it would have its own amplitude. Another frequency would have its own phase, its own amplitude. And if you summed all those up, you would get exactly the signal that you fed into the FFT, the Fourier transform, in the first place. Now, a few pragmatic details. You can't get really, really low frequencies unless you have really, really long samples to feed into the Fourier series representation. And if you have a time period T, then the lowest frequency that you can hope to represent is 1 over T. That won't go through one cycle during the period of period T. So if you have 2 hertz, or you have 2 seconds, then the slowest signal that you can hope to represent is 1/2 hertz, because a 1/2 hertz waveform will take 2 seconds to have a full cycle. Okay. Now, so if you're interested in really slow frequencies, you just want to have really long chunks of data to feed into the Fourier transform. Okay. And the resolution, you don't get infinite resolution in the spectral dimension. You get frequencies at discrete areas, is 1 over T. So if I have 2 seconds that I feed into the FFT, then I'll know what the power is at 1/2 hertz, at 1 hertz, at 1.5, at 2. So it's 1 over T, 1/2 hertz resolution. If I have a 1 second window that I feed in there, then my resolution is 1 over 1. I know it's at 1 hertz, 2 hertz, 3 hertz, 4 hertz, 5 hertz, but I wouldn't have finer resolution than that. Now, what we get out of the FFT is actually a phase spectrum and a power spectrum. And as I mentioned, there's this phase component that says where in the cycle does each waveform begin, and what's the amplitude, how much power does a given waveform have. And with both of them, you can put them back together to completely reconstruct the waveform. Now, often psychophysiologists use just the amplitude component, although this is, they're getting more and more interested in phase, and we'll talk about that in some of the advanced signal processing lectures. But for some of these early applications I'll talk about, we're just looking at amplitude effects. Now, what you get is the power spectrum, where we look at frequency on the x-axis and power on the y-axis, and for each frequency, we have amount of power. We saw that in the class demo. And you can also get an amplitude spectrum. It's just the square root of the power spectrum at each point. And sometimes people use that because it's not quite as skewed. Okay. So here's what it would look like translating from the time domain to the frequency domain. Here we have a perfectly sinusoidal periodic signal, right? Something never found exactly in nature. And the frequency spectrum looks like this. There's no power. There's a bunch of power right here at the frequency of oscillation, 10.25 hertz, and then no power out beyond that. Okay. Here we have a more complicated waveform, but you can clearly see there's some kind of dominant frequency. Peak, 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 peak. That should show through, and in fact it does. So there's a big peak right here at whatever that frequency is. Turns out it's 9.75 hertz. But there's also a lot of other frequencies there as well. Perhaps it's some noise, maybe it's some meaningful signal, but that comes out in the FFT as well. Here we have a signal with no single dominant frequency, and it has an absence of higher frequency noise like that one. And you see there's a bunch of different frequencies. No one predominates, but there obviously was a filter. There's nothing after 20 hertz here. So the signal had been filtered prior to going into the FFT. And then here we have a complicated waveform, but it has greater periodicity to it. It's more regular, say, than this one. And when we look at it, there's three distinct components to it that have summed together to create that waveform, 12 hertz, 15 hertz, and 20 hertz waveform. So that's how you get used to looking at these power spectra as they map on back to the original waveform. Okay. Now, any given waveform may not give you the most reliable estimate, but you can look, if there's a lot of noise compared to the signal you're interested in, you may not see a lot in the single epoch. But in this case, we have noise that's twice the amplitude of a 10.25 hertz signal. And a single FFT shows, well, here's the 10.25 hertz power spectrum bump. There's a lot of power in all these other frequencies as well. But if that's noise and it's not always present to the same degree, then 5, 10, 30 epochs, the noise can start to kind of reduce, and what you're left with is the peak that's present consistently across those. So if you think about EEG now, if you just take a second of EEG, your power spectrum might have the bump of interest but a lot of extra noise. But if that noise is not always present or it changes over time, then you average together 5, 10, 30 seconds of EEG, you're going to get a more reliable estimate of that which is present throughout, in this case alpha. You're probably wondering about the lingering details. So, in the absence of the phase information, you can no longer reconstruct the signal. But usually, if you've gone to this amount of trouble, you don't care about reconstructing the signal. You're using this to characterize the signal, not to reconstruct it. Because an infinite number of signals could produce the same amplitude or power spectrum if we didn't know the phase. Right? If you thought about it, an evil experiment where you set your nephew or niece down to the task of putting together all kinds of sine and cosine waves and varying their phase, they could come up with an infinite number of waveforms out the other end, given the same amplitude sine and cosine waveforms but with different phases to start. Okay? So you have to have the phase information to construct your original waveform. Now, spectra are most often derived by the fast Fourier transform, Tukey, the same Tukey we have to thank for, you know, Tukey's honestly significant difference and Tukey's least significant difference and all kinds of other Tukey tests. Tukey devised the fast Fourier transform, which, as the name implies, it's faster than the regular Fourier transform. And it works, however, only if you have a signal that's been sampled by a power of 2. So it's sampled at 64 hertz, 128 hertz, 256, 1024, and so on. Now, this used to be a huge concern. Given our processing of computers today, if you're not doing a lot of processing, you can do what's called a discrete Fourier transform. And the discrete Fourier transform doesn't require the power of 2. But if you're doing a ton of data processing, the FFT still can have substantial savings. I can't remember. It's something like a tenfold increase in efficiency in deriving this. And by band-limited signal, I just mean you don't have any violations of your Nyquist frequency here. Right? Sometimes you might also see something known as the autocovariance function. This is where you see what's the correlation of a signal with itself if you lag it a bit, and lag it a bit more, and lag it a bit more, and lag it a bit more. Well, once you lag it enough that you've gone through one whole cycle, it's going to correlate highly with itself. So, kind of a poor person's FFT. So here's our signal. And when it's lag zero, here it is, it correlates perfectly with itself, right? The correlation between this and this would be 1.0. And then if we lag it, let's say we lag it so it's like, at some point it's going to go to zero, and at some point it's going to go to negative one and back up to one. So as a function of lag, you'd have some measure of the correlation or the covariance, and this thing would be maximum at certain lags, and those lags would tell you what that frequency is. Just another way to look at it. But usually we would be using the FFT, the fast Fourier transform. Now, remember I talked about a periodic signal might look periodic, but if it doesn't end exactly through one cycle, then you're going to have this discontinuity. But there's a trick for handling that, and that's known as windowing. Okay, and the most common of these is the Hamming window or the Hamming taper, so I'll show you what that looks like. So, here we have a signal. Maybe we could turn the lights off again for this, if you please. So this is a nice signal, and it certainly looks periodic, right? It's all regular, but it stops here. So if it started again, it would start here, right? And that would be that would not be periodic. It would have to start here. So if the signal finished here, we'd be fine, but it doesn't. So the Hamming window, then, is a solution that applies a series of weights where the middle point is weighted unity. It gets a full 1.0 weight. And then there's a taper so that the points near the end are weighted very close to zero. There are variations on exactly how you form this bell-shaped window. And so if you look at programs, you'll see cosine bell window, Hamming, Hanning with an N, to name just a few. But they're all variations on this theme of how you're going to put this window on here. So now this series of weights is applied to this red waveform, and again it comes up in purple, I'm sorry, but you can see now you have a signal that kind of goes back to zero And you can imagine this signal starting up again and being periodic, because there wouldn't be any kind of discontinuity or rapid change in direction here. So the Hamming window allows us to take a signal that's periodic, but we just didn't get, you know, an exact integer number of cycles of the signal, and essentially force it to look periodic. And when you do this, then you don't have trouble with the FFT. Okay. So this is just an example. Go ahead. This is just an example of what happens. Here's again a periodic waveform. Doesn't go through an integer number of cycles. So when it comes up again, if you connect those dots, you get a waveform that doesn't look like a single frequency. So if you don't use a Hamming window, even if you have a single frequency you feed into it, your FFT will give you a power spectrum that has some other frequencies in there to try to account for this effect. Okay, so we've covered some lingering details, and now you're wondering, well, what are the pragmatics of all this? Okay. So you obviously you have to sample fast enough that no signals exceed your Nyquist. Because if you violate that, you're in trouble. You've got aliased signals, and you'll be making grand interpretations about things that don't really exist. Okay? You want to sample a long enough period so that the lowest frequency can go through at least one cycle. Because if you don't, you won't be able to resolve that frequency. You want to sample a periodic signal, and there are probably a few. You know, it's probably not reasonable to think that across 2 minutes. That whole two-minute period is a periodic signal, that would actually repeat exactly again. But you might be able to think, well, maybe I could take a second or a half second. I take a small chunk of data. That might be closer to a periodic signal. Also, if you have a subject engaging in a task, you probably want to make sure they're engaging in that task for the entire duration of the EEG you take. So let's say they look at an IAPS picture, you collect your EEG. If you do it for all 6 seconds, they're probably having multiple experiences while looking at that picture. Multiple brain systems are coming online, going offline. That may not be the right level to feed into it. You may want to look at 1 second at a time or a half second at a time. Okay. So, and if it's not periodic and there are some discontinuities, depending on how bad they are, you're going to get some additional frequencies in the FFT to account for that. And a really good example of that is shown here. We have in our data what we affectionately call steps. Okay? This is not biological in origin. It's an amplifier artifact. I think it's actually a DC compensation that the amplifier puts in. So you're looking at all these channels of EEG going by, and this one, it makes an adjustment. But that's not biological in origin. So this is EEG just prior to this screen. Looks fine. There's no discontinuity. This is the sample you see here, and there's the step. It's huge. It's bigger than the signal. Okay. This is the power spectrum for the good data. This is the power spectrum for the data with the step in it. Okay. And what you can see is, you know, all else being equal, you'd think these two would look quite similar. They're on the same scale on the y-axis, but you can see all frequencies. And these are color-coded, kind of conveniently. Blue is delta, green is theta, red is alpha, yellow is beta, and the white is gamma and EMG. And 50 and 60 hertz are color-coded purple as well. It's kind of a handy way to look at it. But you can see, not only are high frequencies represented, but also the frequencies you might be interested in, let's say alpha, or beta, or theta, are also amplified. They're exaggerated. And this is all because of an artifact. And what the FFT does is it assumes there's a bunch of frequencies present that are out of phase, they're canceling for most of the time. So you don't see a lot of impact of these frequencies until, miraculously, they line up here and they produce this step. So this is a non-periodic signal. And what an FFT does, assuming periodicity, is how could periodic signals do this? Well, they're all canceling out until they can't cancel out right at that point. And wham, you get a big jump, and then they start canceling out again. So it's an artificial deconstruction of the signal. The deconstruction of the signal is adequate if it's periodic, but if it's not periodic, you get all these extra frequencies. Now, sometimes you could have a biological signal that might not be so periodic either. A saccadic eye movement to one side, for example, could cause some trouble. It wouldn't be as egregious as this, but it could still cause some trouble. Okay. So what I think I'll do, because it'll be a good review of some complex material next time, is I'll begin, after taking 3x5 questions, with some actual data and walk through step by step. Let's take this time domain representation
and we'll cut it up into some epochs, and we'll do some FFTs, and we'll look at the ultimate frequency representation of the signal. Okay. So next week you've got St. Paddy's Day, and we're not going to be here, so I'll see you in 2 weeks.